Hey, so can we start off by talking about the new themes on Discord that you can unlock with Nitro? Have you seen this thing? Because it's fucking big and bold and taking up like a quarter of my Discord.
Well, that's it's a weird way to start a D&D podcast, but I guess Yep. Sure. Who are you again, Mr. Discord man?
I'm the Grumpy Dungeon Master Jay.
Are you sure? Because you're talking about Discord.
Well, I mean, that's what we use. The Grumpy Dungeon Masters even have their own Discord channel, which everybody should be joining.
Yeah.
Come game with us. And you are Grumpy Dungeon Master who?
I am the dreaded Discord Dungeon Master, Grumpy Christopher.
Grumpy Christopher.
Grumpy Christopher.
Yeah, it's just, it's neat, the new themes that you can just, I'd have to unlock Nitro or buy Nitro or whatever, and I'm not going to do that. But I can click them, and it changes the color of my Discord.
Now, you see, I already pay for Nitro for the server, so we have better audio quality for the podcast.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you actually could do all this. You could have like a purple and black Discord, which is pretty sweet.
Yep. And we also let us do like little background images on our D&D stream. So we can have our characters behind us. Everyone in our group does it except for Dimitri, who's one of our longtime players.
Yep.
He's like, I'm not paying for Discord. I'm like, you don't have to.
Yeah, I don't blame him. Like, I don't either. And I use Discord pretty regularly, you know, most nights.
Yeah, use my Discord. That I pay for. And my Google Drive that I pay for. My website that I...
Well, okay, let's be fair. I don't really use the Google Drive.
Yeah, what's backups?
I've got them back. I got everything backed up on a separate drive, so it's fine. As long as my house doesn't get hit by a tornado, we're fine.
You live in Tornado Alley.
Yeah, well, it is what it is.
That actually segues perfectly into what I wanted to talk about.
Oh, player or characters getting run over by tornadoes? Awesome.
Well, natural disasters. So, like, in a lot of times, a natural disaster, if it's not a volcano, if it's not a hurricane, something that we, with our current technologies, can look at and predict and kind of judge where things are going, and thus get people out of the way of harm's way. Do you use any kind of natural disasters, or have you ever used natural disasters in your game setting? So just like, oh, all of a sudden, flash flood. Tornado. Other than used via plot device, I should add.
I have never done it, and mind you, this is me saying that, which does not include dragon, because I have used dragons burning down entire villages before. But
are
they
natural?
I mean, in a fantasy setting, they kind of are. It has kind of the same effects as a fire or a tornado coming through a small village.
Yeah, but at that point in time, isn't the dragon just a plot device for the players?
It can be. The only time I can think of I've burned down, a la Trogdor, a small village, it was intended to try to get the characters to care more about more about life loss, more about civilian casualties than it was about killing the dragon. And maybe it's my player group at the time, or maybe it's just I as a DM wasn't quite good enough to pull that off. Like some players are going to be more apt to care about that kind of stuff than others. You know, some players just, you know, I just want to find the dragon and kill it. Oh, look, he killed 52 people. Whatever.
So the only natural disaster that I can remember ever using, and this wasn't something I wrote or established, was the Adventure League Rime of the Frost mating modules, where the very first module basically has you coming from Neverwinter through the spine of the world into Neverwinter proper.
Yeah.
Or sorry, into Icewind Dale proper. And you're hit by an avalanche.
Oh, is that the one where they had to fight the wolves at the beginning?
Yes. The wolves come and scavenge everybody. And that's where they have to fight the Shardalian owlbear at level one. Like, why? Yeah,
like, good luck.
The hyper-intelligent owlbear with Shardalian claws at level one. That's a BBEG if I ever saw one. Not a level one, just like, oh, we gotta fight it. But that aside, that's the only time I've actually can remember a weather effect being used in gameplay. And I'm including landslides as a weather effect, because while they're not a massive natural disaster,
it still is. Yeah,
it still is. You know, it kills like four skiers a day. Who knows? Yeah.
I mean, the equivalent mudslide in California just a couple of months ago was wiping out entire towns. So,
yeah. So, that's all I can remember. Like, I do remember, like, oh, this island here has massive, like, whirlpools or hurricanes that derail ships, that sink ships and destroy sailors. But I've never actually thrown one into my campaign or used one. Like, I'm, you know, running the Waterdeep one, I had like a city fire take place, but that's not a natural disaster. And it was, plus it was caused by the bad guys.
San Francisco would beg to differ. Like, that city has been burned to the ground before from, you know, fires. So it, like, fire is a natural disaster,
I guess. But it's just weird that I don't see it happening that often. That, like, maybe it's the wizards and, you know, using control weather to stop natural disasters from happening quite a bit. And that's something, I guess. But then we've kind of talked about this in our private conversations a lot, about how wizards can't do everything and solve every problem because the access to the weave is limited. And if magic just solves all the problems, there can't be any conflict, because magic would just solve all the problems. That's why there's starving people and hungry people and a poverty injustice in the Feyrun, because the wizards can't stay ahead of that. They can't pull that much magic out, even though your heroes can do it on a daily basis.
Yeah. Like, there's a couple of reasons I think that natural disasters aren't really utilized, especially in written material. One, it is, like you said, it's utilized only as a plot device. And that's because that's the simplest way of doing it. If you have a natural disaster, as like, you could even actually run a thing where the natural disaster is the majority of the module, you know, just a one shot or whatever. And a lot of it would not involve combat. A lot of it would involve trying to save people. And that's not necessarily what D&D players, at least, play for. I'm not going to say there aren't some that would enjoy that, but that's not the focus of the game. It never has been, probably never will be. I'm not even sure how rules-wise you would implement all of that. Then there's the issue of, as you've talked about, it's magic. You live in a magical world. If you have enough wizards of high enough level, and this is campaign to campaign, city to city, you know, however you want to do it, but with enough wizards, you can prevent most natural disasters. Oh, look, it's a mudslide. All right, everybody just use Shape Earth. Problem solved.
Yeah, there's not enough time. I mean, you'd have to have hundreds of wizards just at the beck and call to be able to do that, to stop the impending mudslide. But, like, wizards using, like, here's a good example. Playing Adventures League this week, and I told the players that they have basically 10 days worth of travel throughout space. And they are on a giant ghostly galleon run by a vampire captain.
Now, this is for Spelljammer.
For Spelljammer, yeah. So the players are like, okay, well, we needed food. Do they have any food down below? I was like, feel free to check. You have open access to the ship. And I have the person go down to kind of look through the food stores, and all they see is just a bunch of chained up humanoids and various creatures, some in certain states of decay and rot, and some within, you know, certain bounds of starvation. because they're vampires. They're vampirates.
Right.
They don't eat food. Yeah. And the best part is that the lawful good paladin was just like, okay, this is a thing. Close the door. Goes back up to the top of the ship. Doesn't address that problem at all.
What?
I know, but it's Avengers League, so I don't care.
Oh my god.
Right. And they're like, okay, well, Druid, can you make Goodberry? Yeah, I got Goodberry. Okay, I can make Goodberry every day. Yay, Goodberry solves all of our survival problems.
Yeah,
I've never was a spell I banned from a campaign. It's Goodberry.
Yeah, enough druids, and you can feed entire populations without even thinking twice. Wouldn't even need that many, really. You know, a few dozen.
No,
druids.
You get 10 Goodberries per spell slot.
Well, even barring that, I don't know about in 5th edition. I know at least in 3rd there were spells that could increase the growth rate of trees and crops and everything else. You know, things that druids actually would want to do.
Yeah, they have those, and that's part of the druid kit in 5e.
Okay, I didn't remember that. I've never actually played a druid in 5e.
Well, I know they're there because they're like the problem spells. Like, yeah, you should be able to have a bunch of wizards being able to go out to the farmers and like, all right, we're going to cast enhanced growth on all your food and make this farm super plentiful so there's enough food to feed all of Waterdeep.
Yep.
Okay, great. So the farmer's out of business. Food's super cheap because it's in super abundance. You know, that drives down the tavern prices, that drives down the price people pay for stuff, and all of a sudden, I don't know what that does to an economy. I'm not an economist, but I'm sure it's not good.
It, at least in Forgotten Realms and Faerun, that is not much of an issue because they still have a lot of farmers, which means there just aren't enough druids to make that a thing.
Well, it's not just enough druids. A lot of it, the common thing that I see is that it's impossible to access the weave that much to cast spells at such a grand scale to affect that much to affect that issue as a whole. But like going back to the original point about natural disasters, there are spells that cause natural disasters. Control weather being like it stops a hurricane, right? Right.
I mean, how many times have we talked about tsunami on here? Ad nauseum.
Go reference our episodes about drowning the Underdark. So it just kind of came up, and I was thinking about it for a little bit, and just it's really Faerun has a lot of problems in the setting. And part of that is the wizards are there and they should be solving all the problems, but they're just not for whatever reason.
Well, honestly, a lot of it, I think, is because there are so many villains. So with just as many heroes as you have three times as many villains. You know, you can't expend all of your resources trying to solve every problem just for the standard populace when at the same time you're having to figure out methods of dealing with mind flayers and dragons and Fae and everybody else that wants to wipe out your little slice of life, you know?
Yeah, but at the same time, taking Waterdeep as just the example that's on the top of my head, you look at just the NPCs that are in the Yawning Portal, okay? You have the barkeep, Durian, okay, who's an extremely advanced fighter, okay?
Right, he's a fighter. He's not going to help with any of
that. He can't help. But he still is a fighter that can literally tank most of the problems physically in the city and fight them to a standstill, you know? Most of that comes from his magic weapon, but he's still a very high-level fighter. Then you have the bard and all his connections to the Harpers. You have the half-orc and all her connections to the Antarum. And then you have Dragoon guy, whatever his name is, and all his connections to the guilds. And they're all high-level PCs, okay? So these are what you would consume, like, the above-average person would be in those orders. And these are just the guys at the bar. So for every one of those that's at the bar, there's probably two that are at home. And then you factor in that there's seven of them there. there's still a lot of very high powerful people that can come out and actually fix a lot of the problems that just don't. Durin doesn't go and try to stop the gangs in Waterdeep. He just wants to run his bar. So is he just being lazy at the point in time? Or just like, why don't these people who are already high level save the world that they're already in? And then when you look at it, the adventurers that you play in the game level up so fast in comparison. You're talking about like maybe 6 months at max to get to a very decent level.
That's a 5. That's a 5e problem. That is a 5e issue.
Regardless, no one's solving problem. The favorite is what I'm trying to get at. But there's no natural disaster, so somehow has to be solved at least that problem.
I mean, part of it, I think, is a numbers issue, you know, because you mentioned other 7 people who are incredibly high level in the Yawning Portal, by far the most famous bar in all of Faerun.
Yep.
You know, that's like saying you'd go to Club 54 and not, you know, and you're going to see famous people. Of course you are.
Okay, fair enough, but I'll counterpoint that. A second.
Well, hold up. But Waterdeep is 130,000 people, according to Google. So 130,000 people. How many people in that city are 10th level or higher? 1,000? 5,000? Probably 5,000 or less are 10th or higher. I would think it's probably closer to 1,000.
Okay.
And now, how many of them are actually good alignment? So if you just kind of split it down the middle, you're looking at 500 that are of good alignment, that are 10th level or higher. And you're dealing with a population of 130,000 just in the city. It says there are more than 1 million people within Waterdeep's territory. So you're looking at 500 people to fix all the problems of the Waterdeep territory while combating who knows how many bad guys. Like, yeah. I just don't think the numbers add up.
That may be, but it still feels like there should be a lot more problems solved by the massive amount of super strong people that exist in 5th edition that just run around. I mean, I'm not saying Lady Silverhand needs to run around and fix all the problems herself, but there's a lot of people that have a lot of power that just aren't doing anything.
It sounds like the United States of America, where you have a lot of people with a lot of power who don't fix anything.
Okay, well, fair enough. Actually, something to go back to a bit, that you're like, oh, the most famous tavern, of course they have high-level people there. So when I was running the Waterdeep game and kind of setting up things, I was looking at this really cool map of Waterdeep, and it has like little blurbs of like major locations. And I picked one location because it stated that it had a well that accessed the Underdark. And I was like, okay, I'm going to use this in for a plot point for my wife, who's playing a drow. All the drow are fleeing the city because of persecution against the drow due to the slaughter of the Illustrate Temple that happened by a drow.
Her
so all the drow are living. Yeah. Drow fighting drow. So I used the Blushing Mermaid as the focal point for this and did no more research into this inn, okay? Then my wife, being the amazing person that she is, starts doing research into the Blushing Mermaid. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that, yes, while this does have access to the Underdark, it's for a completely different reason, okay?
Okay.
Now, this is just a random bar, not famous by any means, not talked about really anywhere, but does have a good Wikipedia entry. So the Blushing Mermaid Inn in Waterdeep is a place where you go and you get food and tavern stuff, and mermaids or people or merfolk are the waiters and servers and whatnot, and it's a seafood based restaurant, of course.
Okay,
so that's the theme of the restaurant.
Hold on, how do they serve you?
They have like little water paths that they swim up to with the food, and they give it to you.
Oh, I need to go to this place.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. The artwork for it from like 3rd edition is pretty cool. But here's the cool secret part about it. It's actually run by an archlich.
Of course. See?
See? But she's a good Archlich who basically uses her presence in Waterdeep to basically get info on other greater undeads that may kind of like show up in the area. And she tells the Waterdeep leadership whenever threats like those arise.
Okay.
And so just another random bar in Waterdeep just has an Archlich as a the owner upstairs. Just ready to Archlich her way through all the corpses.
And of course, somehow they're a good guy Archlich, despite the fact that you have to do very evil things to become a lich.
Well, I mean, I guess I did the air quotes good guy. You couldn't see that because that's a podcast.
Oh, okay.
She's still definitely very evil, but her neutrality to Waterdeep is basically what makes it from kicking in the door and trying to stop her. So that's just a thing that's in Waterdeep.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that was kind of neat. That's the most famous bar. Of course they have big people. Yeah, well, that one has an Archlich, and it's like 2 blocks down.
Yep. Yeah, but at the same time, nobody would know that. It's just sort of a behind-the-scenes thing. It's very Illuminati.
So, getting back to the point about the natural disasters, I guess I haven't really done much searching for content for natural disasters, but I'm sure there's got to be some out there.
And
I may actually look into it, because it does seem like something that needs to be, that has to be out there somewhere that people have done stuff with.
I guarantee you, if you go on the DMs Guild, or at the very least drive through RPG, there's something on it. Like somebody probably has a supplement that they wrote specifically for running encounters via natural disasters.
I just would hope that they're just not all survival encounters, because that's not what I need.
You don't want to just make a couple of simple dice rolls. Like, for a proper natural disaster, man, that's a night's worth of adventure. We've all seen all of the, so many of the movies, like Avalanche and Deep Impact, and just shit like that. And
right.
I mean, they're entertainment, and you could definitely do something with it.
Oh yeah. Speaking of the movies, my next topic. I'm very upset because I did not learn about this until 4:30, 5 o'clock today here on Sunday when we're recording this podcast.
I already know exactly what you're going to talk about. I found out around 5 o'clock today.
But people who have Amazon Prime were allowed to go see the Dungeons and Dragons movie today. And by the time I saw it and looked it up, it was already showing. It showed at 2 o'clock at a theater that's literally walking distance from my house. Why did I not know about this?
I didn't know
it was on Prime. Why didn't I get the email? I would have seen it. I guarantee you I would have woke up and saw it.
As long as it was as long as there was a theater within, say, 45 minutes of here, I would have grabbed my brother and we sure shit would have gone to see it. And then I'd go see it again next weekend, probably. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't come out until the 1st.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. 31st, I think.
Yeah.
So that weekend. Yeah. But I could have already watched it. I have Amazon Prime. I've had it for years. And I never knew about this until after it was over.
Oh, so mad.
Like, seriously, guys, you couldn't advertise it better than that?
It's like you want it to fail.
And the only reason I even found out about it was because I'm in a couple of like Dungeons and Dragons Facebook groups, and it was people who were watching it who posted, "Hey, look what I just saw."
Derpeter, I saw the movie before you, bastard. I hate you.
Yeah, I want to see the movie. We all want to see the movie. Oh,
I'm
well.
So upset by that. That ruined. Well, I didn't really ruin my weekend, but that made me grumpy.
Yep, it made us grumpier than we already are, and we're already old men, so.
Yeah, my back hurt. I had to lay down on the couch. Oh, God.
Yeah, imagine sitting in a chair for 2 hours watching the Dungeons & Dragons movie. You wouldn't be able to stand up or walk afterwards.
That's why I always pre-order my tickets and get the assigned seats where I can put my feet up.
Ah, yeah, okay. All of the theaters around here have the really fancy seats with the push button where they lay back and all. It's really nice.
Oh yeah, I love those seats because they always break every time I sit in them. I can tell you without second guessing myself that I have broken at least six movie chair seats and probably double that in things that I went, oh shit, I bet that's broken.
Oh, I had this. Remember, like when we were at LARP and I rode up to the Mexican joint with you, I was sitting behind you and I was terrified the whole time. I was just waiting for that seat to snap and then me die. My legs. Ah, you crushed my legs.
Yeah, I don't have that as a random encounter thing in the Dungeon Master's Guide. A bar stool breaks.
Oh, yeah. A fucking ogre. Just hanging out in a bar, and it, you know, accidentally crushes the halfling that was sitting behind him.
And starts a war between the halflings and ogres.
Yep, that's the beginning of the ogre halfling wars from 200 years ago. Which
the halflings lost horribly.
Yeah, I mean they all became dinner. That's why there are no halflings in that world.
I saw something a little while ago where someone was showing off their interpretation of halflings. And it was a really cool concept that, honestly, I wish I could find them and then, like, give them money so I could use a concept. I may just steal it anyways.
Okay.
And it's basically halflings are pretty much humanoids for all intents and purposes, but they're they always have, like, a positive demeanor. They're always happy-go-lucky, and they like food. The typical halfling Tolkien expressions of halflings.
Yes.
But the reasons you don't see them is because halflings are not just short, stout, furry-feeted people. It's because even though that is what they normally are, that's only what they are when they're around other halflings. When they go and move into a human civilization or an elven civilization or a dwarf civilization, over the next couple of generations, those halflings will just, in the way halflings work, by blending in and always kind of being stealthy, will adopt traits of the culture that they're in. So, you know, a halfling family that's lived with generations for the elves become taller and slender and get pointier ears. You know, the dwarves, they get even shorter and squatter, you know,
okay,
and start growing beards. And the human ones, they kind of like even out all around. I thought that was kind of neat because that's kind of what happened in the Tolkien works too, where the hobbits were just becoming more and more and more human as the generations went by, and eventually just melded in to the human race. And so I thought that was really neat, and they had like these accompanying pictures that go with it. Like, here's what the girl looks like as a halfling, and here's the other variations of her. I thought that was really neat. That's a nice, good spin to put on a fantasy race that's been talked about and stuck in lore forever without going too far from it. You know, you're adding something to that race, that idea, and it works out pretty well.
Yeah, that's not a bad concept. Honestly, if you run something or put together your own little campaign, you could have that as being the lore of the halflings.
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason you couldn't just use that.
No, I thought it was, like I said, I thought it was neat. It was just a nice little spin to put on just a very well-known
stereotype. Speaking of halflings, I have to bitch for a minute.
Okay.
Disney canceled Willow after one season.
And then uncanceled it the next day.
Did they?
Yeah.
What? I hope so.
Yeah. They said that it wasn't canceled. It's just they're not working on a second season now because they want to reevaluate how they want to produce it. As in, they're debating on doing another series, a television series, or another movie.
Okay. Well, it was supposed to be three seasons. I'm not seeing I see nothing about it being uncanceled. It was supposed to be three seasons, and I watched it. The first episode was really good. It felt like the original movie. I grew up watching the original Willow movie. Like, it was fantastic. I love it. After that, the show did kind of go downhill. There was a few great characters in the show, but overall, it just kind of felt like a TV teen drama with some action adventure thrown in. You know, it wasn't anything that you wouldn't like see on the CW. So yeah, I understand why there was big fall off on people watching it after the first or second episode. But it's still Disney, and Disney has so much money that I can't imagine them not being able to just say, we're doing 3 seasons. We'll just make a better second season.
Okay.
But I don't know. I hope that they continue with it because I wanted to see all 3 seasons. Damn it. I just want more Willow. And I know they could make it better than it was.
Okay. So here is the clarification from John Caston, who I assume is the director or something.
I don't know who he is, but go ahead.
He's involved with the show. It says, the truth is less splashy. Here it is. A decision was made last week to release our main cast for other series opportunities that may arise for them in the coming year. With all the TV and movies and productions around the world, it feels unfair to limit an actor's availability without a clear sense of when you're going to need them again. It further trivialized by a simple reality that the scripts we've been working on require just as many actors from our first season, with whom no such contractual hold exists. Nothing prevented Annabelle Davis, for example, from taking another show, but you better believe that Mims appears in every single Volume 2 chapter. If you're asking what this means for a viewer, it means that as the creator, I guess he's the creator, here's what I think it means. Due to the forces much larger and more intricate than I ever pretend to fully understand, production of streaming shows is slowing down across the entire industry.
Yes.
And Willow won't resume filming in the next 12 months. But here's what equally true. With the enthusiastic and unwavering support of Lucasfilms and Disney, we've developed and written what we hope is a brain-meltingly fun, richer, darker, and better Volume 2, which builds on the characters and stories from the first 8 chapters, The Worm Survives. Whatever that means. So yeah, like I said.
So,
they've been released from their contracts, but they have a Volume 2. They will be working on it. It's not on the table yet to be worked.
Okay. That gives some hope. I think it's weird that you would already know that you're making 3 seasons of a show and not already have everything locked in, especially with Disney, you know, the company that puts people under decades long contracts.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing too, is that they said that they released them from, hey, we're not going to lock you down for the next 12 months. We don't know when we're going to be filming again.
Yeah,
and that's unfortunate.
I'm just saying they could, if they already have 3 seasons that they know they're making, they could have easily have already just started filming.
Well, that comes from the whole idea that
I think what it was is the first season did so terribly that they've decided, okay, what we were going to write, we're not going to write. We're going to make a lot of changes. And then maybe, well, I'm sure it seems likely that they'll continue it, but they have to do some major rewrites.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that happens.
Yeah.
I've never seen Willow. I don't have a ball in the game, so.
I would highly recommend seeing the original movie because it's Dungeons and Dragons when you didn't have the special effects to properly do Dungeons and Dragons. So
I heard it's Val Kilmer's best work.
Yeah, actually it is. Mad Mardigan is an amazing character. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, go watch the original. It's well worth it. And I'm pretty sure you can just watch it on Disney Plus.
Yeah. I mean, I could, but I don't know. I've seen Krull.
No.
And it makes me feel like I've seen Krull.
No,
I don't know why.
No. Krull is I will call it an entertaining film. It is not a good film. Willow is George Lucas, if I recall. I'm pretty sure it's a George Lucas movie.
It is.
Yeah. like, it's actually a good film.
Right.
It's not Crawl. It's nothing like that. It's a family fun action adventure movie from the late 80s.
I really like Crawl, though.
I like Crawl. I still watch it every, you know, 5 or 6 years, probably.
I haven't seen it since I was like 6.
Yeah, well, it's probably best you don't go back and watch it, because it's not a good movie. But
I just remember the Cyclops from Goonies is in it, and he gets crushed.
I don't think there was a Cyclops in Goonies.
Yeah, it was. He was like locked in a basket, and he kept saying Baby Ruth.
Rocky Road? Yeah, but he was not a Cyclops. He had two eyes.
Yeah, he had
one of them kind of looked off to the left and was definitely displaced on his head, but he had two eyes.
You know what they theorized where, like, the legend of Cyclops came from, right?
I know I've heard, but I don't remember. Go ahead and tell me.
It came from because that region didn't have elephants naturally, but they would find elephant skeletons, like, rarely. And when you look at an elephant skull and the whole skeleton, it looks like a giant human with just one big asshole for an eye. And that's where they theorize that they came up with the idea of a Cyclops. And I'm sure there's plenty of babies born with one eye back in that time. So,
yeah, deformities happen. But yeah, that would make sense, because the Cyclops is supposed to be a giant. And, well, if you see an elephant skull, you're going to think it's a giant.
Yeah, I mean, Google elephant skull, you look at it, and you're like, yep, that's a Cyclops. Like, it doesn't even register. You're like, that is exactly what a Cyclops looks like.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if I knew nothing about any of it and I'm out wandering around and see an elephant skull, I'm going to be like, holy shit, Cyclops is real.
You can't convince me. I've seen one.
You can't convince me otherwise. That's awesome. So, you know, I got access to all these new books, trying to figure out what I'm running next. I talked to some of my players that are going to be involved in it. I will be running the Oriental Adventures next.
Okay.
So it'll probably be a month or so. I still have to find a few other players that can be there consistently. And the goal is to just sort of run it once or twice a month. And then I'll still be playing in other D&D games on the other weekends, hopefully, if everything works out. I'm just trying to get back to playing, you know, 4 weekends out of the month, as opposed to 2, if we're lucky.
Yeah. I mean, that happens. Like, my schedule right now is so messed up streaming the thing. Like, there's 2 weeks that we can stream, and 2 weeks that we can, and 2 weeks that we can. Like, that's really bad for the viewership, but it's just hell on the players and everything, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because we're doing the Dark Souls game, and we were supposed to play this weekend, and 3 people canceled. So, yeah, so that didn't happen. Which means at this point it'll be 4 weeks. If I get to play next weekend, which is unlikely, it'd be 4 weeks without any tabletop.
Yeah.
So, like, I just got to figure something out, because, damn it, I want to play. This is my livelihood. It's what I love to do.
Yeah. Speaking of new books, I got an amazing new book. I showed it off last night on the stream, and I want to talk about it here real quick. Let me grab it.
Yeah. Talk about it before I start talking about Rogue Trader. So go ahead.
So I purchased the second that you linked it to me and I saw it on TV or on YouTube. That is, Ed Greenwood has a YouTube channel now.
Yes. Yes, he does.
Yes. And so I looked at his profile on DM's Guild. And
he has a
lot of shit, because Ed Greenwood, pretty much the guy that made all of Faerun.
Yeah.
And there was his most recent book that he was shelling out for mostly for the YouTube channel. And it's called They, Land of the Red Wizards. And it's pretty much a source book from Ed Greenwood himself about how and what's happening over in the land of Thay for 5th edition.
Well, what is Thay? That's not on the Sword Coast.
Yes, it's not on the Sword Coast. It's very far away on the western side of Faerun.
Eastern, but yeah.
No, it's on the western side.
No.
Sword Coast is... Yeah, you're right. Sorry. I thought nobody worms slimy eats for a second there.
I mean, I guess if you go far enough, if you go far enough west, then it gets back to the east, unless the place is flat, which I don't think Faerun is.
No, yeah, Faerun is flat. But it gets kind of... The book is kind of cool. It's got a... I haven't gone through and been able to read everything in it. It's got some original artwork concerning Thay. It kind of goes into who the Red Wizards are, how important magic and magical training is for them. Kind of like how like all the higher ups in the city are all evil, but the populace isn't generally. And it kind of gets in. It talks about the slavery roots and addresses that. And it kind of just goes through like major points of interest. And then it starts going into more details about the actual culture and how things handle there. So much so, in fact, that it actually has like about 10 pages of the current cuisines, like the major cuisines of Thay, including recipes and how to cook them.
If you watched his first video that he put out on his channel, he actually talked about that specifically. And apparently that's a thing that he does, that Ed Greenwood actually does, is he creates all of these recipes and then puts them into his books. Like, he actually goes out and makes this stuff.
Yeah, it's crazy. And there's actually pictures of the food, so I'm guessing that's the food he actually made.
Most likely.
So yeah, it's just really cool. And like I said, I've really been digging this book, and it goes into much more detail than I could possibly ever use. But there is a thought of me of trying to like pick up the Dead and Thay Adventure.
I mean, it is.
Pretty much it is. But it goes through everything that you would possibly need, so that'd probably be a good primer book for me.
Oh yeah.
And then I bought my wife a Christmas gift that just arrived, and she told me to get it for her. It's Dungeons and Dragons: The Legend of Dritz Visual Dictionary.
I saw that came out recently. I actually saw it yesterday up at my bookstore.
So let me tell you that this is probably the best book I have seen in recent memory to inform you about what Faerun is and how Faerun operates. It literally goes through pretty much every single setting, every single major city on the Sword Coast, and a lot of major monsters, and gives you a visual description of them along with like a stat block, not like a stat block, but like stats about them.
See, I didn't hold on. I didn't flip through the book because it was, what was the title again?
Dritz Visual Dictionary. Well, he's like three pages of this.
Yeah, okay. See, that's why I didn't flip through it. I just saw Dritz Visual Dictionary. I thought it was going to be detailing out his birth to where they're at in the books currently. I thought it was all about him.
Nope, it's all about Faerun and how Faerun currently works.
That makes it way better.
And this book is amazing. Amazing. Like, I shit you not, like, if you play D&D and you want to reference liches, that's just a page I opened up to, there's amazing visuals of Acerak and Vecna, Valindra, Shadowmantle, like what a demi-lich is, the difference between a demi-lich and a normal lich, and then, like, talking about the Thayan liches and the Arcane Brotherhood. Like, this book is insane.
That's useful information. Yeah, that's
this book has more information than any other book they put out for 5th edition. The page on goblinoids alone is more knowledge than that's in the monster manual.
See, this should have been one of their standard releases within the the four books or whatever the hell they release every year. This was not even something I knew about.
So like the traveling section of this book, it kind of goes through like Dritz's travels throughout the Sword Coast. So it starts in Mitzel-Barazian. Don't kill me, Shelley. The Underdark, the Silver Marches, Icewind Dale, Luskin, Mithril Hall, Neverwinter, Waterdeep, Baldur's Gate, and Gauntlegrim. Gauntlegrim.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it has, I shit you not, two pages, if not four pages, or... Hold on. Icewind Dale is six pages. page after page after page of just what's in the Underdark and what the towns are made up, what Icewind Dale happens, this is the book you need to run fifth edition stuff if you want to have any idea of what's there.
I mean, I talked about them releasing a book like this multiple times on this podcast. I told you
it would never work, but all you have to do is just say that it's Dritz's book and all of a sudden people buy it.
Well, I don't know that anybody's buying it because I didn't buy it. I didn't even look at it because it's like, oh, it's a Dritz book. If they had said the Encyclopedia to the Forgotten Realms, I would have picked it up and been like, this is awesome.
Yeah, like everything is framed around Dritz's travels, but like I'm looking here at just Waterdeep, okay? It's six pages of just Waterdeep lore, what things are, the city, like the walking statues, the docks, the city guard, the lords, timeline, who the Griffin Riders are.
Yeah, remember, you were like, if they can't do a timeline. I'm like, yeah, they can. They can do it in the course of about four pages.
Well, this goes from 1032 DR to 1489 DR.
And see, you can definitely do a timeline, no problem.
Well, I mean, that timeline, to be fair, was us talking about a very detailed timeline year by year.
Yeah, that's fair.
This is a quarter of a page just with some major points.
I mean, honestly, if you're looking to run games in Forgotten Realms, you don't need the entirety of the timeline. You just need something current.
Yeah. So I am just floored by this book.
I'm floored there was no advertising. I'm floored that nobody knows this thing even exists because this is what everybody's been wanting. And
there's half a page on just Xanathar.
Yeah. Huh. Good job, Watsy. Continue to fail. Glad you released a great book. Advertise it next time. Like no one knew this thing was coming out.
My wife did because she told me in November, it's like, hey, this is what you're getting me for Christmas. I was like, okay.
Yeah, but your wife probably just wanted it because it had Dritz on there.
I know. I stole it from her. Don't let her know.
Yeah, I definitely
want it on my shelf.
So very quickly before we wrap this thing up, I say very quickly, we got 10 minutes or so, but I wanted to talk about Rogue Trader. What?
It's amazing, isn't it?
So I'm vaguely familiar with Rogue Trader. I ended up with the Dark Heresy book. I ended up with Death Watch and ended up with Rogue Trader.
We're talking about 40K now. We shifted gears massively. So just try to keep up.
Well, if you listen to the podcast every week, which you should be, you would know because I talked about it last week. But so Warhammer 40K does have a role play setting. The three books I just mentioned are different settings, as it were. But so Dark Heresy is sort of your general, you're not going to be playing Space Marines, but you might be playing everything else under the sun, but you're working probably for the Empire of some form or fashion. Death Watch is you're playing Space Marines. That's what the setting is. Neither of those really super appeal to me, but Rogue Trader absolutely appealed to me. And I've known about it for years, but never actually gotten a copy of it or gotten to play it. And it's, first off, let me say, I absolutely love the Warhammer 40K setting. I always have. It is a fantastic setting. Don't really care about the miniatures game, but the setting is fantastic. You know my love for Dune. Well, this is Dune 30,000 years even past where Dune takes place.
Okay.
I mean, it is. Yeah, it's very much based on sort of a medieval hierarchy of things, which is what Dune is. You know, you have the emperor, you have all your commoners, you have your noble families fighting amongst each other. And then I always kind of think of it as after Dune happens, you know, the empire still maintains, the emperor gets sort of encased in whatever he's put in, and then they start harvesting souls to keep him alive for another 10,000 years. And that's kind of the setting of Warhammer.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, but with Rogue Trader, it's kind of neat because it's more like a game of pirates. You have this giant city-sized ship that flies around through the warp of space and you have a writ of trade, as it is, as it were. Mm-hmm. And you just fly around and make trade deals and play piracy and whatever the hell else adventures you can get into out on the open seas / warp.
Yeah. The way the game we were going to play was pitched to me was Firefly and 40K.
That's not completely inaccurate. Yeah.
It's not completely inaccurate. It's a little inaccurate because the full Rogue Trader rules is for that giant, massive city sized ship. But there are, you can narrow it down even further and just be a trading vessel of that Rogue Trader. And that's what we were going to play. And it sounded like a lot of fun. I mean, you still have all like the 40K kind of feel and, mm-hmm. you know, doom and gloom and kind of dark grim to it.
Yeah, it is.
So if you like that, yeah. I mean, it's definitely looks to me like a lot of fun. So, yeah, go ahead.
Sadly, I'm not going to get to run it anytime soon since I'm going to be running the Oriental Adventures one, but I'm going to keep this on the back burner. At some point, I will run this thing. I've read through the majority of the rules, and honestly, I really like the rules system. It was very quick and easy for me to learn because it's very Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
It is percentile based, but at the same time, you still have your stats as normal. You have skills, you have feats. I think they call them talents, but it's just feats. And so much of this feels like building a D&D character.
Yeah.
The one other thing that they had in here that I really liked, because with this setting, you really kind of want a backstory, or at least you have to be able to tie all of the characters together. And one thing mm-hmm. they have in here is they call it intersections. So when you are creating a character, you can either, you basically have six intersections that you're going to be picking from: homeworld, birthright, lure of the void, trials and travails, motivation, and career. And you hand it off to the first player, and they will go through this list of things. Then you hand it off to the next player, and they go through the list, and so forth. And you, it's, think of it as columns. There's six columns, and you'll pick from the top. So say homeworld, and you pick imperial world. So the next one below it is birthright, and there are Savant is directly below Imperial World, but you could pick to the left or right of that. Mm-hmm. So Child of the Creed or Vaunted. And I'm not going to read what all of these are. But as you go down this list, you just pick. And that helps you flesh out your character's backstory. And then as characters are created, you're going to have overlapping points. So maybe two of you end up with the Lure the Void Zealot. Well, at that point, those characters have something in common. There's a reason for them to know each other or care about each other.
Yeah. I believe when I made my character, I was the engineer of the group, like I was the tech priest.
Yeah, they call it something else, but it's effectively a tech priest.
And so I could talk to the machine god, and I could talk to I was the engineer, essentially. So I could talk. For those who are not familiar with 40K, essentially there's billions upon billions upon billions of years of code and spaghetti code that exists in 40K. And no one knows what programming is. They just know that when you give inputs to a machine, the machine comes back with other inputs. And so they basically go into weird sacrifices and cult rituals to get the computers to do what they want to do, for lack of a better explanation.
That's the most accurate description I've ever heard of 40K.
Oh, great IBM computer. Take this baby's soul, clack, and let us know what we're doing. Error, null. You can't return line and address to 44.
Yeah, 404.
We must go 44 million years and light years into the space and kill null, the chaos god. Okay, right.
That's
40K tech priests.
Yeah, the class you're talking about is called the Explorator.
Okay, and my character saw a chaos breach on, I believe, my home world, my imperial world, and I kind of just a little crazy because of it, because you can't see a Chaos Demon without going insane. And that was just kind of the backstory. I saw it. I kind of escaped the purge that happened from seeing a demon. And I now live a life on a rogue trader because I don't want to die.
That, yeah, because you don't want to die. So you just live on a giant ship that flies through the warp.
I mean, it's that or basically go back to my home planet and get killed by, you know, space marines because I saw a Chaos Demon. I am a heretic to the Empire because I saw a Chaos Demon.
Right. Yeah, that's a fair point. Because, well, they're all religious zealots. All of
them. So I live on a rogue trader. what are you not getting?
So one last thing about it that I love that they do it this way. So there's effectively 8 levels that you can level up in the game. It's not particularly high level. But as you gain experience points, those experience points are actually just spent to buy skills and upgrades. Mm-hmm. And you know, if say you have a ballistic skill of 25 and you want to increase it, well, you could spend 100 points to get another 10 on top of your ballistic skill, depending on what class you are and so forth, which I think is a really cool little process for leveling up. You're not truly leveling up. It's not in the D&D sense of, oh, you've got 2000 XP, you're now level 2 or whatever it is, and these are the skills you get. Yeah. It could be, well, this adventure I earned 400 experience points, I'm going to buy this skill and this other skill. And some of them do still have prerequisites. You might have to have the first level, the first rank of it before you can get the second rank of it. But overall, really, really kind of a cool system. I am looking forward to getting more into it at some point. But for
it looked like it was going to be a lot of fun. It was always kind of sad that we never got a chance to get off the ground with the game, but
yeah. Yeah.
It's what it is.
Yeah. Now I will have to do a lot of reading as I am not super familiar with the Warhammer setting. I love it, but it's one of those things I've always been kind of intimidated by it, especially to run a tabletop game of it, because I'm going to end up playing with somebody who really knows the lore and I'm not going to know what the fuck I'm talking about.
Yeah, there's actually a couple of really good TikTokers that I follow them, but just I know of them, and they go through like a lot of the big history of what is 40K. So you can get a general gist of that world, but essentially you just go as dark as you possibly can. And that's pretty much par for the course for 40K.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, there's a lot of terminology that's used in 40K that you kind of have to be privy to. Like, what the fuck is an Astartes or a Mechanicus? And Astartes and Mechanicus are very, very common terms in 40K. But if you don't know anything about 40K, then
that's fair. Yeah. I mean, just exposing yourself to it for a little bit. There's a Humble Bundle going on right now where you can buy all the 40K books if you want to read them.
Well, I don't need to. I have 3 or 4 Rogue Trader books. I mean, there's a fuck ton of in here. So
I guarantee you the Rogue Trader books really don't go into the Horus Heresy.
No. Well, I actually have the Horus Heresy novels here.
Yeah. Just read those. You'll be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually just saw a video about that. And there was a sect of space marines, I believe space marines, or not space marines, but a sect of humans. They're the spellcasters. And they looked into the future to see how the galaxy would be post the Horus Heresy, because it was basically about to happen. And so if Horus, who's the bad guy, because he's aligned himself with the evil demons,
yep,
the devils, essentially, if he were to win, human civilization would collapse into a massive civil war, and eventually the humans would exterminate themselves. And because the humans exterminate themselves, they would stop relying on the warp for travel, and the warp would then basically heal itself, because every time they warp, it would cause a rip in space-time, causing demons to come through. And eventually the universe would normal itself out, and once the humans were all exterminated, the universe would be in a better place because the humans are gone. So they align themselves with the bad guy because they want to basically just stop the Emperor. Because the Emperor, who's the good guy, he wants to keep the humans alive and is essentially God incarnate.
Yeah, and they sacrifice 1,000 souls to him every day. Such a good guy.
Yeah, well, such a good guy. Just to keep his psyche alive, yeah. He's essentially the good guy. He's the guy that brought peace and prosperity to the human race. But the human race having the technology that he granted them is causing all the other problems in the universe. So these Marines kind of went heretic and joined the bad guy side to basically kill the Emperor, knowing full well that they were going to lose, which is kind of weird when you think about it.
It's all prophecy. Yeah, they had to do the thing that they knew they had to do.
And orcs are mushrooms.
That is true. They are fungi.
They're a combination of fungi and meat.
Yeah, but the whole terminology thing with 40K, I'm having to actually go through the exact same thing with the Oriental Adventures Rokugan setting. I'm seeing constantly just words. I'm like, I don't know who these people are. But I've been reading through the book piece by piece, starting to sort of get it all together. I'll probably talk a good bit about it on the podcast next week.
Yeah, and that's a lot of what it is. It's like if you're a blossoming DM trying to get into something, a lot of it is just finding a setting that you really enjoy, or making a setting that you really enjoy that you can put a lot of time and effort into learning the lore of, so you can turn around and invest your players into the world. Yep. And a really good example of that is me. No, but seriously, a good example of that is in my last game. I had set it up so that the players needed to go to the City of Dead, which is a section in Waterdeep, and go to the Castle Lantern Mausoleum and look into the last coffin for a super secret surprise. They're like, immediately as players, they snap when they got the letter, like, okay, let's go in at night. Let's sneak in and, go into the coffin so we don't get caught. And I was like, go ahead and give me a history check. And it really didn't matter what history check they rolled. It's just player engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So they rolled a history check, and I think one of them got an 18. And he was knowledgeable about all things Waterdeep. So I gave him, because he got a good roll, I gave him the whole spiel that I personally knew about the City of Dead, which is that the City of Dead is open to the public during the day. 100%. Anyone can come in and walk around. It's a massive, park, essentially. Just there's dead people there, and not like gravestones, but more just like different mausoleums. So all like the nobles and city even have really nice houses that you can sit at and pay respects to. It's not like a dreary graveyard. It's just a big part of the city, a lot of fancy architecture, and like I said, it's open to the public, but trespassing there at night is not allowed. If you get caught, you get arrested for trespassing, because no one can go there at night. Why no one can go there at night, I really honestly don't know. I assume it's because they don't want people digging up the graves, or some other nefarious reasons.
That's when necromancers do all their work, is at night.
There is a knight, I can't remember his name off the hand, but it's in the Waterdeep Dragonheist book, that patrols. He's taken his life mission as a retired knight to patrol the graveyard at night and keep people out. So you have a 3% chance of running into him. I believe that there is a neutral flesh golem that also comes out at night and just kind of like lumbers around, but I'm not sure about that 100% canon wise. And another thing is that whenever dusk hits, hundreds of drift globes float up from within the city and fly to the City of the Dead and just hover over the City of Dead at night, giving it and basically lighting the entire place and giving it dim light, the entire thing. So sneaking in is hard at night, but then again, it's open to everybody during the day. Just go there during the day.
Yeah.
And so the players,
unless you're a necromancer and need bodies.
Right. So the players immediately went like, okay, let's sneak in at night because that's what you have to do. And then once I explained the setting to it, because I you know, really like the Waterdeep setting, they're like, oh yeah, we'll just go there right now. we don't need to sneak in. It's fine.
Yep. Yeah. So having knowledge of a setting, having deep knowledge of whatever setting you're running is helpful for sure. If it's your own homebrew, you can get away with coming up with shit on the fly. Just try not to forget what you tell people.
And just like the Blushing Mermaid, it's your homebrew. So there's no Archlich there in my Waterdeep.
Yeah. Honestly, even if you're running, even if you're running a pre-built setting, it's your game, man.
Yeah.
Change things if you need to. So, all right. I think I'm done.
All right. Bye, Jay. Bye, Craig.
Bye, guys. Bye, Craig.
I miss you already.
Bye, Craig. See you on the other side.
Sweet Craig. Your eyes are so pretty.